looking forward to chatting with Dr. Jennifer Bryson. She is a fellow at the Catholic Studies Center at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, a translator from German to English, translated several works by Ida Frederike Gores, which we're going to discuss today. She's an adult convert to Catholicism with a PhD from Yale in Greco-Arabic and Islamic Studies. She has worked in government service, including as an interrogator at Guantanamo Bay detention camp. Her work often addresses the Catholic Church, questions of man and woman, society, foreign affairs, and how to keep politics out of sports. Boy, Jennifer, I could talk to you about so many things with your bio, but we're going to concentrate. Fascinating, just fascinating. God bless you and your great work. We are going to concentrate on your translation of Ida Gores's Bread Grows in Winter. But first, before we get to that, I know you're an adult convert. How did you first hear about Ida's great work and writings?
In 2019, I really stumbled on her indirectly through some almost completely unrelated work I was doing. Had a new contact in Austria, and I looked up some information about the contact before emailing her. Found out she created a website to help Catholics meet to marry. It's a matchmaking website in German for Catholics, and they recommend one book on marriage. And I looked at it, and it was a book from 1949 by an author I had never heard of, Ida Frederike Gores. Mm-hmm. And that made me curious, and I ordered the book, and I also found an online lecture in German about the author and was fascinated. And when I received that book, it's called On Marriage and on Being Single, it's coming out, it was so beautiful and rich and insightful that I wanted to make it available for English-speaking Catholics. And that just, one thing led to another, and I've now translated four books by Ida Gores to make them available for the church today in English.
Well, tell us about her for those who may not be familiar with Ida Gores.
She was born in 1901 and died in 1971. She experienced a spiritual awakening as a teenager that brought her from an indifference to the Catholicism of her childhood, which had been cold and just formalities she had to go through, to living faith. And she devoted the rest of her life to the church. She was a very gifted writer, and so her gift to the church was writing. After her Catholic high school at a Catholic girls' boarding school, she spent 2 years in a novitiate with the Sisters of Mary Ward, discerned that was not for her. And she was then involved in the 1920s in an amazing Catholic renewal in German-speaking Europe, Germany and Austria, that we don't hear much about today, but it's really a treasure chest of great Catholic authors. So that really formed her. And her spiritual renewal happened through discovering the saints. Mm. And she became most famous for the renewal of hagiography in the 20th century and bringing the saints to us in the 20th century. And she also wrote many works on the church, such as Bread Grows in Winter, which we're going to discuss today.
Yes, and when will that be? You're translating that as well, correct?
That was published in November 2025, okay. So very recently by Ignatius Press.
Of course, they have such great books, especially on these wonderful people who have contributed over the years. I just love this. Now, in particular, Bread Grows in Winter, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's a collection of her essays, correct?
Yes, it has four essays and two lectures by her that are from 1967 to 1970. In addition, I asked Ignatius Press to include in this English edition of the book the eulogy delivered for her in 1971 by her friend, who was then Father Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI.
Be still my heart. And, I love him. Sorry, yeah. I just love Benedict so much. Go ahead.
Oh, and that's because in his eulogy, he draws extensively on and repeatedly quotes one text by Ida Gores, and that text is in this book, chapter 6. And this way, readers can see right before them, going back and forth, the relationship between her work and his. And also in the introduction to the book, I highlight for the readers examples I have found in his work after her death, referring back to Ida Gurris, in particular to this book, Bread Grows in Winter.
Now, in reading some of your commentaries, Dr. Jennifer, I noticed that you mentioned that she's not that well known in the world where she's from. She's better known here among Catholics. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because the tone in the church, in the American church, is quite different right now than in German-speaking Europe. The American church is so beautifully, wonderfully vibrant. Right now in Austria and Germany, there's a contrast of small but tremendously spiritually rich communities, small ones here and there, like dots on a map. But the institutional church is, well, to put it mildly, let's say struggling. And also, Ida Gurris, when she died in 1971, one reason she was forgotten or really swept away so fast is that the very politically oriented and progressivist powers that already had control in the church in Germany by the time of her death, that we see today in the synodal way and things like that, for them, Ida Gurris was the kind of voice that they just said, oh, we don't do that anymore. We don't want to, you know, we don't want to hear about that. But she is evergreen. She's amazingly relevant to Catholics in the church today.
That was my next question as to why we should read her today in the church here in the U.S. We're talking with Dr. Jennifer Bryson, translator of Ida Gurris' book, Bread Grows in Winter, and a number of other of her publications. So let's talk about for whom you did this. I mean, I know this means a lot to you as an adult convert, as a Catholic, but who should read this book, do you think, Jennifer?
This is a book, one thing is it's for a broad Catholic audience. Mm-hmm. Bread Grows in Winter is, I think there are academics who are going to find little gems in the book, but Bread Grows in Winter has essays and lectures that were delivered in broad general public Catholic publications. Ida Gurris was highly learned, but not an academic, and her heart was always to write for the man and woman in the pew, to move them from faith as maybe a vague cultural identity to individual faith on fire. And one picks that up in the essays in Bread Grows in Winter. For example, the first chapter, which is called Our Image of Christ, it's written in the form of a letter to someone who is starting to become troubled in, I believe it's a young man, in his faith, because he's hearing academics and modern theories say wild and really crazy and disturbing things about Jesus. Maybe he didn't even exist. And she writes to comfort him to say, look, others are going to say whatever you can imagine, but who Jesus is doesn't change.
Mm. Wow. Wow. It sounds like you have such a passion for this, for translating her work, that it means so much to you. I can hear it in your voice.
Well, to be honest, I do. And I found her work at a time when I had gone through many years of confusion about the church and spiritual dry time, and I've been coming out of that. And at that time was when Providence, you know, God placed her works into my hands. And she also contributed greatly and continues to contribute to my own spiritual life because she's so relevant today. And also she writes in a very beautiful manner. Her prose is beautiful, and she also, as an author, she's passionate about connecting with her audience, and you pick that up in the way she writes.
And the way you write, Jennifer, and speak. Thank you so much, Dr. Jennifer Bryson, translator of the work of Ida Gurris, especially the most recent translation, Bread Grows in Winter, published by our friends at Ignatius Press. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Catholic Connection. It is a Wednesday, time for Italy's Shrines and Wonders Wednesday, based on my book, Italy's Shrines and Wonder, which came out earlier this year from EWTM Publishing, working right now on a second edition, Italy's Shrines and Wonders 2. God willing, will be coming out from EWTN in early, well, I would say late spring. We're looking at June, hopefully, God willing. And this one is going to be Italy's Shrines and Wonders, discovering sacred spaces and fascinating places in the life of St. Francis of Assisi, because 2026 is the year of St. Francis. It is a big deal. And when I was talking to some of the guides in Italy during our pilgrimages in 2025, they told me, at least for Italy and Europe, it is going to be as big as a Jubilee Year of Hope, because St. Francis, of course, is a patron of Italy, a patron of Europe, and an extremely popular saint around Europe and around the world. Now, there's going to be a big event starting in February, one of the major events, February 22nd to March 22nd. They're actually going to be removing his mortal remains from the crypt, the lower crypt, in the Basilica of St. Francis in Assisi, of course. And they're going to make them available for public veneration for only a month. So it wraps up on March 22nd. We are going for that. If you'd like more information, just simply go to my Facebook page, Facebook at MrsTeresaTomeo.com, or my website, TeresaTomeo.com. But the traditions in Italy are just really quite beautiful. And of course, they involve faith and food and lots of fellowship. Now, my father would always say, Buon Capodanno. Buon Capodanno. And that literally means top of the year, or head, the head, Capodanno, capo, head. And so that's why they would say that, the beginning of the year. The Italian term Capodanno literally means head of the year, signifying a fresh beginning and a symbolic reset. By the way, I'm getting this from this really cool website. There's so many great websites with history of Italy on them. This is called understandingitaly.com. And they explain, again, the Italian term means head of the year, signifying a fresh beginning and a symbolic reset. The night of December 31st is also known as San Silvestro, named after Saint Sylvester, whose feast day falls on that date. Now, in some areas, the religious aspect is less prominent, but it still is a major force, especially in the smaller towns. So there's all kinds of interesting things that they do. Let's start with the food. Of course, food, because it's Italy, plays a central role in the culture. New Year's no exception. So the feast for Di Capodanno, or New Year's Eve, is one of the most important meals of the year. As I was saying, I think I've mentioned this before, that the Italians continue the holidays all the way through the Feast of the Epiphany. It's not like here in America, where unfortunately, Christmas night, it's over, and you move on. And you celebrate New Year's, New Year's Eve, and then that's it, you move on. No, they continue to celebrate through the Feast of the Epiphany. So the idea behind every dish is chosen with care. They're very simple dishes, but very profound. What you eat on the last Sunday of the year is believed to influence your fortune in the next. As a result, certain foods are considered essential, while others are avoided altogether. Now, the New Year's Eve dinner, in typical Italian fashion, is usually enjoyed later in the evening, often starting at 9 or 10 o'clock and stretching past midnight. Families and friends gather around the table, sharing stories, laughter, and a sense of anticipation as the clock approaches midnight. Now, this is a big deal. No Italian New Year's Eve table is complete without lentils. The small legumes are the most iconic symbol of prosperity and financial abundance. Their round, coin-like shape has long been associated with money, and eating lentils at the turn of the year is believed to attract wealth. Another popular item, well, pork. Especially where Deacon Dom and I live half of the year in Umbria, pork is everywhere. So the regional dishes do vary in terms of the types of recipes that they use, but normally the lentils are cooked very slowly with vegetables and lots of flavorful herbs and sometimes some tomatoes, and yet it's very filling because lentils have a very good protein value. So it's delicious, by the way. And of course, pork. Pork is another essential element of the Italian New Year's Eve meal in many regions, especially in the north and the central part of the country. So they also avoid some dishes on New Year's Eve. Fish and poultry are often excluded. The belief is that birds can fly away, symbolizing fortune escaping, while fish may swim away, taking luck with them. So now the big deal in Italy outside of the home, and this is just so incredible. I'm sure Joan will have a lot to say about this. The fireworks. I have never seen fireworks like I have in Italy, and not just on New Year's, but for any excuse to have fireworks because they're always celebrating a feast day. But New Year's Eve, it's huge along with those public celebrations. Fireworks, as this article indicates, integral part of New Year's Eve in Italy. Public displays are organized in many cities and towns, often accompanied by concerts and live performances. And private fireworks are very common, creating a spectacular and sometimes, and I remember this, chaotic display of light and sound. Now, years ago, we were on a pilgrimage. We did a women's pilgrimage, and it was over. It was from, I think it was December 26th through, I think, January 2nd or 3rd. And I remember New Year's Eve, we went to a very nice restaurant in Rome, and it was kind of, it wasn't near the Vatican. It was just a little bit, maybe a mile away from the Vatican. It was lovely. They had music, and we were all dancing and having a wonderful time, of course, toasting in the New Year with a little bit of Prosecco, which is the sparkling wine in Italy. And all of a sudden, we heard all this noise, and we looked out the window, and the fireworks, and this was in more of a residential neighborhood, they were everywhere. I mean, from balconies, from restaurants, from rooftops. And they were not official. They were just, again, folks in the neighborhood doing their own fireworks displays. But when you're in Rome, if you're in by some of the big piazzas, such as Piazza Navona or Piazza del Popolo or Piazza Repubblica, that's where you'll find the big fireworks displays, and very much near the Colosseum as well. So there are a lot of beautiful, beautiful things that the Italians celebrate. Each holiday, I think, especially Christmas and New Year's, are so special. So if you can get there for one of those, it is just so unique and so beautiful. And of course, faith is still a very big part of the celebration. And you'll still hear the song, Tu scende dalle stelle, descending from stars, as in Jesus, from starry skies descending. That was a song written by St. Alphonse Liguori. And the celebration of Christmas and New Year's can still be seen in St. Peter's Square with a nativity scene based on the area of St. Alphonse Liguori, Campania, Naples. Lots of fireworks, lots of good food, and of course, lots of faith and fellowship, Italian style, for New Year's. We'll be right back. Welcome back, and we are staying in Bella Italia this New Year's Eve day with our dear sister Joan Lewis, Joan's Rome. And Joni, you heard me talking about the fireworks. Isn't that the truth, though? You don't even have to go to one of the major piazzas to see the big fireworks displays, or over to the Colosseum where they have these incredible shows. You can literally stand looking out your window and see the fireworks, right?
Well, that's what I've done every one of the past few years, and as you know, I'm right across from Vatican City and and St. Peter's, Basilica and everything. But when you look out my window and look to the left, I don't know what's over there, but there are fireworks lasting 10, 15, 20 minutes. Huge, huge numbers. This is not something from somebody's balcony. And so the first year I'd heard fireworks, I went to my window because I could tell they were in the neighborhood, and I was absolutely astonished and went back to a nearby table to get my camera and just filmed, which is exactly what I'll do tonight. So I had hoped I might be at the Pope's Te Deum, but they were totally out of tickets, and I didn't know if my, because I have a Vatican ID that often works in place of a ticket, but for an event like this, I know they're very, very requested. So it'll be very beautiful, be on the air very shortly at 5 o'clock Rome time. And so, but you know, just talking about the fireworks makes me think of how visual Christmas is as a holiday. Maybe the only holiday in America to be more visual would be July 4th because of parades and fireworks and everything else. But I mean, you come to St. Peter's Square, or so many squares in the city, but St. Peter's Square, the nativity scene and the beautiful tree, the 100 Cribs exhibit, which will only be here for a few more days. Amazing. The cribs in churches.
Oh, they're just amazing.
I know. They're totally.
Well, I didn't tell you. I should send you the picture. Before we left our little area of Umbria, our little church, which is very tiny, only holds about, you know, our little parish and our little village, only holds about 75 people. Joan, the crib, the creche, the Presepe was as big as the altar. As big as the altar.
I know.
It was phenomenal.
Sometimes in the bigger churches, the side altars get taken over, if you will, by the creche. But, I mean, in Rome, little squares, big squares, you named, you know, Piazza del Popolo and so forth, lights and trees everywhere. And
everywhere.
I've come to the conclusion, I never knew exactly what number the word gazillion was referring to, but I think it's referring to the Christmas lights in Rome. I mean, there is not a building that
absolutely right.
Not hundreds, but thousands of the mini LED lights. And then also, if you want more visual images of Christmas, there are a number of places around Rome, mainly near Piazza Risorgimento, which you know is like five blocks away from St. Peter's Square.
Right.
And one of the main shopping streets is the Ottaviano, Via Tunisi, which is in front of the Vatican Museums. There are very big video images of Pope Leo that dominate the facades of these buildings. And so what they are, they're photographs, they're reflections taken from his speeches, and they're offering messages for the Christmas season, and of course, as we all hope, an invitation to hope. You know,
that would be so cool. Now, I know doing those images that are shown on the buildings, that's pretty popular. I mean, they do that in Assisi because in the front of Santa Chiara, there's a beautiful scene in front of the Basilica of St. Francis was stunning. And then other churches as well around Italy. But that must be amazing to see and hear the Holy Father. Wow. On the buildings
like
that.
Well, Teresa, you know what struck me in particular as I was looking at images of the Holy Father around one of Rome's main shopping centers, you know, the secular side of Christmas, was that no objections to this. I mean, this is a Catholic country. There may be people who haven't practiced their faith in a lot of years. There's other people who are practically martyrs, you know, in the faith and their love of God. But if they put up something like this, there's no objection. You don't have people marching against Pope Leo's images on the facade of a building.
Right.
And that just warmed the cockles of my heart, the fact that something like this could be put up and loved by many, many people. And if there were those who didn't love it, they let it be. And so that's just so, so, so important, you know. But I do think Christmas, it's obviously a very, very wonderful, meaningful, I mean, the birth of our Lord and our Redeemer. Even in countries where you've got Christians as a minority, and for example, you know, on Pope Leo's first visit, he went to Turkey and to Lebanon, and certainly in Turkey, the minority Christians. But you're still going to have joy and enthusiasm and beautiful. You're going to have lights and trees and the crib, and you're going to have it there. And then again, you come to a country like Italy, you know, a Catholic majority. And I think it's kind of sad in France, once a Catholic majority, the church has always called France, you know, its eldest daughter, and the numbers don't reflect the, you know, the past. They don't reflect the numbers of practicing Catholics and everything else. But this does seem to be, when you look at mass attendance, Christmas, New Year's, and so forth, Teresa, this does seem to be something that does unite people in their faith. Even if they've been away a while, short time or a while, they're going to find themselves needing something more than they get out of everyday life. And they're going to fill the churches Christmas. And then the day after Christmas, of course, in Italy, it's the Feast of St. Stephen, the first martyr, and a public holiday, obviously. And tomorrow will be a holiday, but Friday it's kind of back to work, those who can.
Then you have the Epiphany next week, was a whole nother celebration.
Oh,
but
yes.
Don't you find, too, that I think, and I wrote a blog about this, that even when you have, you know, secular images, like let's say a Christmas tree really does tie into, obviously, has faith traditions in there as well. But even in these towns in Italy that have these big celebrations, for example, I told you we finally got to see the largest Christmas tree, outdoor Christmas tree in the world, Gubbio. which is amazing. But when you associate those things in the villages, everything is rooted in the faith. I mean, when we were in Gubbio for the tree this year, every, as you said, Joni, every corner had a crush. There was something relating to the real reason for the season. And the same in, of course, Lago di Tresomino, where we saw the Christmas tree on the water, which also is breaking world records, by the way, which is phenomenal. And
good.
So there's always a connection. They never separate it. There's always, even if, let's say, okay, in some areas, Italy isn't as Catholic as it was, but they remember the reason for the season. That's what I find so endearing.
But they, that's it. If somebody doesn't celebrate in a big way and they have fallen away or something like that, still they know in their heart, whether they even say it openly or not, in their heart they know what this feast is. It's been around for 2,000 years. The Savior was born, you know, 2,000 and I guess 2,025 years ago. And they still know that there's strong roots in that. There's truth, period. There's truth in this day, whether they want to accept the full truth, whether they, if anybody who, you know, is not fully practicing today, whatever their reasons are. Teresa, these are the people I pray for. And I want to join my prayers to people who I know are even bigger prayer warriors than I am, and just pray for those who've fallen away. What happened? You know, I ask God to touch these people and make them realize, just give them, make them have their own epiphany, you know? And so it's just so important. And there's, you know, big and small gestures. I wrote about one on my blog 2 days ago. I brought a whole bunch of things over to the nuns, right? Three blocks down, the Missionaries of Charity, Mother Teresa's nuns. And they have this home in which they house a number of women, homeless and poor. And then they also, about five or so in the afternoon, they provide meals. And that's just for men only, not people who live there, but who come knowing these nuns give it. And so I brought a number of things for the women. You know what I brought, which I've given them before and they love? You know the amenity kits we get on in business class on airplanes?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Teresa, I have drawers filled with them. I'm not going to have my own airline. What am I going to do with this? So, really, every couple of years, I bring them all together. And I've given them, the cardinal who heads the charity office. And then I brought a whole bunch of those over the other day and a whole bunch of slippers and things. And the woman was just delighted. Oh, I had a big, beautiful Christmas wreath, too. But the woman was just delighted. She said, can I wait a minute? So she closed the door, and I waited probably about a minute. She came back. The picture's on my blog. She gave me two little, what looked like Ziploc sandwich bags, filled with a handwritten verse of Christmas. And take the little paper things that you put cupcakes in, the paper container for a cupcake. Put a little statue of baby Jesus and some hay in there. And it's a crib. Nothing on earth could be simpler. She gave me two of these little Christmas gifts. And if you don't think that my heart, as I wrote on my blog, just sang with joy. I just had my eyes filled with tears. Somebody, maybe one of these homeless women, made this little gift, which I will have forever. So it's on my blog of 2 days ago, if you want to see the pictures and the and the verses, you know, handwritten in Latin. I mean, in Italian.
Yeah.
So,
best Christmas gift ever, right?
So that's, yes, exactly. I said that my absolute favorite gift that made my heart sing, and just the thoughtfulness of somebody, the poor, giving gifts. I mean, that in itself should make all of us just kind of bow our head and thank the Lord that if we can do something, we certainly should do it. So.
Yeah.
You know, and we should make that vow in the new year. We've got a new year, a lot on the church's agenda, the closing of the Jubilee and Epiphany.
Epiphany. Mm-hmm.
And then the 7th and 8th, the Pope is meeting with the entire College of Cardinals to, you know, discuss issues facing the church in this our day and time. So new day, new year, new Pope. Exciting times, actually, and times which every day will require at least one Ave for the church.
Yes, amen. And also, I think a new year, a big year, the year of St. Francis, right? In
2026. Yes, of course. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
800. Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
800 years, there'll be tons of celebration, and Assisi probably will have to build some new hotels.
Well, I'll tell you, it's already, it was gearing up when we left and talking to people there, because as you know, we live very close to there. But I think it's going to be fantastic. And I'm excited to see what the Holy Father is going to do with this. He was so wonderfully involved, obviously, in the Jubilee year. But I think he will be a big part as well, even though he's an Augustinian. I know he loves St. Francis. I think he will be very much involved. So we look forward to that. So what are you doing for New Year's Eve? It's about, 3 o'clock there now? Just trying to think. 4 o'clock?
Yeah, it's just before four. But no, I was hoping to get tickets, and I didn't, to the Pope's Te Deum. I don't know if my Vatican ID will get me in. I can try that. But tomorrow will be Mass in my parish and be a lector, and then, you know, meals with friends and everything else. So a quiet eve, but that's okay. I'll be home taping all my fireworks.
Yep. We'll be home, too. We don't go out anymore New Year's Eve. We love being home by the fireplace and just having a quiet evening. And my favorite thing to do, I was telling my, and you'll appreciate this because you know Dom, you know he doesn't last more than like 10 o'clock. 11 o'clock, it's like over the top. So I always take a picture of him sleeping on the couch with his New Year's hat on.
Well, the thing is, here, and on Christmas Eve this happened, all tonight, there will be no buses or transport after 9 o'clock at night.
Well, there you go. Because everybody's going to be watching the fireworks in Italy. Joan, we got to go. Love you. Happy New Year.
Okay.
Can't wait for another year of discussions with Joan's Rome, God willing, starting next week, and we'll talk about the Epiphany. We'll be right back. Hope you can stay tuned for hour number two of Catholic Connection, EWTN's Catholic Connection with yours truly, TT, Teresa Tomeo. EWTN Radio Extra, Google it, as they say, or just go to our website, EWTN.com, and put it in the search bar. It'll pop up. You can download it. So you can listen to both hours, actually, on your phone or wherever. There's an app for that. Coming up in the second hour of Catholic Connection, speaking of Christmas, we are going to the Holy Land, Holy Family Hospital more specifically, and we are going to talk with Ambassador Michelle Bao, and she's going to talk to us about what it's like there right now. And I can't wait, because then Friday we'll get another report from Steve Ray, who has 40 pilgrims there. He left the day after Christmas. I am dying to know how it's going. So it should be a really good conversation with Ambassador Michelle, and also again on Friday with our live show with Steve Ray. Don't forget, tomorrow on New Year's Day, we are going to have a special edition of Catholic Connection. But once again, we will be back live with you. Wishing you a beautiful New Year's Eve and a safe New Year's Eve. And it's really true. We tend to stay home now. And it's funny because Richard and I were talking, and anybody who knows my husband knows that he's a great sport. He'll get out there on the dance floor with me, even though he hates to dance, but he will do it because he knows I love it. And he will also try to stay up to watch the ball drop on New Year's Eve, which I love to do, but he usually doesn't make it past 10 o'clock, maybe 11. And so tradition is, with all of our close friends, he'll still have his little cute little New Year's hat on. I take a picture of him sleeping with his New Year's hat on and send it out. I won't put it on Facebook or anything, because it's a personal thing. I might as well now that I've told the whole world on 600 radio stations, but it's all good. We'll be right back in the second hour of Catholic Connection. Stay tuned. Happy New Year. Honor once again to feature Ambassador Michelle Bao, who is a prominent figure in the beautiful Order of Malta. She serves as the Ambassador of Palestine, the President of the Holy Family Hospital of Bethlehem Foundation, has extensive experience and dedication to humanitarian causes, and she's earned great recognition for her great work, focusing on advocating for the well-being of women and children in the Holy Land and promoting economic development in the region. And I love the Order of Malta. My husband has been a knight for many years. It is a beautiful, beautiful ministry. Michelle, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Great to have you on the program. For those who are not familiar with the dynamic, beautiful Order of Malta, can you just give us a little background, first of all? Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, the Order of Malta is interesting because it's a lay religious order, but at the same time, it's a sovereign entity.
Mm-hmm.
So as a sovereign entity, we have a government, a state, I serve as the ambassador from the Order of Malta to Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
But we're different from other countries in that, you know, our diplomacy isn't worried about economics or politics. We're just worried about our citizens, which are the sick and the poor all the way around the world. So mm-hmm. we have projects in 120 countries, and we just exist to relieve the suffering of people, just like we did at our very beginning 1,000 years ago in Jerusalem. And we are apolitical or neutral, so we are in places where others might not be welcome. And we go and we stay. We don't just go when the spotlight is shining and then leave, but we stay for the long run. And that's why we are in Palestine. We're in Bethlehem. We're in the north of Palestine, just helping to relieve a little bit of misery.
So let's go there right now, because it's very important, since, of course, we had the war in 2023. Things seem to be settling down a bit. What are you hearing? Oh, you're going back, I think. Aren't you leaving tomorrow? You'll be back there, what, on Friday?
I am. Yes, I'm going back. And, you know, the ceasefire is tenuous. There's still a lot of hostilities going on, bombings and et cetera. And so it is, it's going to be a while before the economy, say, of a place like Bethlehem comes back. We know Gaza is going to take many, many years. But even Bethlehem, 45 miles away from the war, has suffered greatly, specifically because there are very, very few, if any, pilgrimages. And secondly, because the work permits for Jerusalem, which used to be 60,000 for Bethlehem residents, has moved down to 4,000.
Wow.
And so that's 56,000 people without employment. 90% of the workforce is involved in tourism. And there's not a governmental social safety net. So families are just reaching out to help another. And, you know, the need is greater than ever. They have to rely on us in the diaspora to be able to help them, to help the, you know, the first Christian families remain in the land of their forefathers,
mm-hmm.
where they've been for 80 generations or more.
So let's talk about the hospital then. What impact has this situation, Ambassador, had on the hospital there?
You know, it's a two-pronged influence. The first is that our patients need much higher levels of health care. We've got more one-pound babies than ever before.
Mm.
We've got, you know, small for gestational age babies. We've got lots of mothers who are in early labor because of the stress, but also because of the economic situation. We've got more mothers than we've ever seen coming in not eaten in a day or two because
wow.
they wanted to feed their already born children. And it just is really a stress. And then on the second hand, they don't have money for services. So normally we have our mobile clinic, gestational diabetes clinic, and menopause clinic for free because we really want no barriers for care. And at the hospital, we subsidize services to 50%, and we have two social workers who can you know, lower them accordingly as needed. But everybody's in need. The middle class is now poor. And so we have raised our subsidies to 85% of what it was before, and our social workers can still bring that down. And, you know, if you think about a baby staying 60, 70, 80 days in our neonatology intensive care unit with premature babies, no family mm-hmm. can afford that now. I mean, hardly any could afford it before. But now it's, you know, we've got 40% of the people in Bethlehem living on less than $1.50 a day.
Yeah, I could only imagine. I mean, when tourism was in full swing, I mean, as you know, I've done many pilgrimages there with my friend Steve Ray, who's there right now. And even getting into Bethlehem was always a challenge, and there were always issues and many Christians, original Christians, leaving because of financial problems. I can't even imagine how they're going to come back. I know it's slowly starting to come back. Some pilgrimages are going, but not too many. Let's talk about the location and the symbolism of the hospital there in Bethlehem. Ambassador, if you wouldn't mind giving us a description of the location, because I think it's so significant.
Absolutely. It is in the heart of Bethlehem. The hospital is a touchstone for everybody who was either born there or one of their relatives worked there. But our hospital is exactly 1,500 footsteps from the very birthplace of Christ.
Jesus, yeah. Wow. Wow. So phenomenal. And I've been to the Church in the Nativity, which is such a special place. And so to have this hospital so close is just so beautifully symbolic, but so important. By the way, if you'd like more information, there is a link on the site where you can donate to support this great work of the Order of Malta, birthplaceofhope.org. And it gives you information on the foundation as well. We have to take a break in about a minute. But Michelle, what is it mostly you want the people in our listening audience to know as we move into 2026?
I want them to know that the first Christians need every single Christian in the diaspora. Everybody needs to come to their assistance. Pope Leo has asked them to sacrifice and stay. And what are we doing to match their sacrifice?
What can we do? I know obviously money helps. What else can we do in addition to prayer and financial support? Are there any activities in which people can get involved to make a difference?
You know, we have a lot of parish activities. We have programs for children, say, in Catholic school or a Christian school or in CCD, Sunday school. And we also have parish giving programs. And, you know, every day is Christmas in Bethlehem. Every mm-hmm. day in the Church in the Nativity, it's Christmas Mass. And so everybody thinks about it only at Christmas, but you could also do a program in May for Mother's Day or during Lent. But we do have really nice Christmas programs or Lent programs for parishes where a parish can really take this to heart. And we've got a giving tag program. We have a speakers program. People can do all kinds of things at a church. They can have a little fundraiser. They can have a baby shower. They can have a basketball shootout. Just takes a little bit of imagination to help the people who brought us the birth of Jesus.
Yeah. It is so important because I don't think people realize without these efforts, Michelle, we're looking at the Holy Land becoming nothing but shells and museums as opposed to the birthplace of Christ. It always will obviously be that. But the people there, they are descendants of the first Christians, and we need to keep the movement and the growth of the families there alive. More with Ambassador Michelle Bowe and the Order of Malta, serving as the ambassador to Palestine and the president of the Holy Family Hospital. We continue on New Year's Eve. Stay tuned. Having a very important conversation with Ambassador Michelle Bowe with the Order of Malta, serving as ambassador to Palestine and the president of the beautiful Holy Family Hospital of Bethlehem, which does such great work. She has extensive experience, dedication to humanitarian causes, and it's earned her, of course, many accolades and much recognition for her beautiful, beautiful work. And it's non-political. It's just helping people on the ground, making a difference. And if you'd like more information about the Holy Family Hospital of Bethlehem Foundation, simply go to birthplaceofhope.org, birthplaceofhope.org, and there's a whole bunch of great information here, the foundation's purpose, their impact, how you can donate. And great ideas that Ambassador was talking about previously on what we could do. Sometimes, Michelle, I think we see these places that are so far away, and we know because of what we see in the news and hear in the news, all the trouble. We think it's just so impossible to make a difference. But what you just mentioned before the break, those are very practical steps we can take that will have an impact, correct?
I have an idea, Teresa, that will help remind us of Bethlehem and to help make it tangible. And this is near and dear to your heart and mine, mm-hmm. but that is our creche, our nativity set,
yes.
given to us by St. Francis.
St. Francis. Mm-hmm.
Don't put it away this year. Leave it
Ooh.
Out. And every time you walk by, say a little prayer for our work, for the Christians in the Holy Land. And on days when you can, take your favorite character in the nativity and put a $5 bill or a $10 bill underneath. And at the end of each month, send a donation in to Holy Family Hospital to help relieve some of the suffering in Bethlehem. You know, Holy Family Hospital brings so much hope. What's more hopeful than a new baby, a job, a training, championing life? We are a pro-life Catholic teaching hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Crucifixes everywhere, trained doctors, you name it. I mean, it is the most holy place. And you know what? We have so many miracles there, Teresa. And I believe it's because we promised John Paul II that we would take care of this hospital. And then he said it was a church priority for the millennium. And we're just beginning our second generation. We're in our second generation of care. And I think that the Holy Family is grateful for our work. And it's why we have so many miracles. They're grateful that no mother has to deliver amongst the animals. And so the Holy Family gives us outcomes that are the same as U.S. hospitals, and even better when it comes to deliveries. The NICU that my three grandchildren were in Santa Monica, California, was the most gorgeous and wonderful NICU. And I'll say it was every bit as good as our NICU in Bethlehem. So a child born in Bethlehem can have the same chance of survival as a child born in the wealthy town of Santa Monica, California.
You talked about the Holy Family being grateful that no child has to be born among animals. Well, you're not talking about just something that occurred 2,000 plus years ago. People may think that in reference to, obviously, the Holy Family. But having been there to the Holy Land 13 times and been to Bethlehem numerous times, crossing over through the checkpoints and all of that and seeing the conditions of some of the neighborhoods, and knowing that there are people that still live among the animals, the Bedouin community, and people who need support, or the people who are the shepherds, like the Bedouin community. That's not something that is just happening thousands of years ago.
No, and we send our mobile clinic out every single day to serve people living, the Bedouins in the desert communities, people in isolated villages, people surrounded by settlements who don't feel safe to be able to leave their property to come to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So we do like what Pope Francis said. He said, go to the peripheries and smell like the sheep. And after a big day with the Bedouin, if you go out and play with the kids and play with the sheep, you're going to smell like the sheep. And that's a good day.
It's such an incredible experience. One of my favorite places in Bethlehem is Shepherd's Field. I just love that. You get such a sense of what it must have been like for them, right?
Yeah. And you notice it's a long walk up the hill for them to have gone from there up to where Jesus was born.
Right.
And I think they left their sheep. A shepherd never leaves their sheep. But this was such a monumentous occasion that I believe they left their sheep and climbed up that hill. No time to round them up. And maybe one guy stayed with them, but who knows? But,
right.
You know, talking about hope, Holy Family Hospital is more than just healthcare. You know, the training that we provide 220 nurses. We've got 12 residents. We now, with the foundation, we have a poverty alleviation program where we are taking care of the needs for groceries, the pharmaceuticals, and electricity for 2,000 people in Bethlehem every single day. And that's a big help. We partner with the Church of St. Catherine, which is the local Catholic parish.
Mm-hmm.
We have a social worker. We have an auditor. And we are really making a huge difference in the lives of the Catholics right there. And anybody else who comes to the social worker is always welcome. You know, we do it because we're Catholic, but we serve all. And we also have a scholarship program where we have 19 young women and a couple men studying to be nurses and midwives. And then we have 7 students with medical scholarships. So we're doing everything we can to provide people hope and a reason to stay.
Let me ask you, what kind of connection, because we know as Catholics that the churches in the Holy Land are under the custodial care of the Franciscans, of course, having to do with St. Francis visiting the Holy Land, believe it or not, in the 13th century. That still boggles my mind. It took him 3 months to get there. It was just phenomenal that he even made it over there all the way to Egypt, you know, with the Sultan to whom he tried to minister. But what kind of relationship? I'm sure you work closely with the Franciscans as well.
Yes, absolutely. Everybody in the Holy Land works hand in glove. We mm-hmm. work hand in glove with the Aramaic Church, and we work with the Orthodox Church. I mean, everybody works together.
Together.
Because we don't want to duplicate services.
Mm-hmm.
We want to magnify the work that we do. And so when we work together in great coordination, it's perfect. And then I coordinate with the different embassies, and because some of them also have projects, and we coordinate with CRS and a lot of those other agencies on the ground. But right now, all the focus really is on Gaza, and the poor West Bank has really been under a lot of pressure, economic pressure, but also a lot of pressure from the occupation. They're not able to leave the checkpoints, and there's a lot of incursions of soldiers, and it's a time of great fear for families, and it's economic fear, but it's also fear about the future. And that's a hard way to live. Imagine if you're a mother and a father having a discussion after your children go to bed, should we stay, should we go, how are we going to feed our children next month? And these are people who aren't used to accepting help. And, we had a small program, poverty alleviation, during COVID. And every single family, as soon as they were back on their feet, came and said, thank you so much, but we don't need this anymore. Mm. God bless
you.
And so it's not permanent. And these aren't permanently poor people. These are people who've been made poor by the situation that they're living in, which they didn't cause. These are just people living in Bethlehem who have had their economy just closed down right on top of them.
Yeah, and they are the most grateful, sincere, loving people. I always loved when we would go and on the pilgrimages that I was privileged to lead, we would have the opportunity to spend an entire day in Bethlehem. Of course, we go to the Church in the Nativity, go to St. Catherine's, go to Shepherd's Field, but then we would have lunch in one of the local, very, very local restaurants, and they just went all out to make sure we were comfortable and well-fed, and they were so proud. They showed us how they made their falafel. It was just, I'll never forget those experiences. The people there, they're so truly, truly Christian.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Order of Malta, another name for them is, for us, is the Hospitallers. And that's because we had sort of the first hospital situation set up.
Mm-hmm.
And so each and every member of the order is a Hospitallers, which gave us the word hospital. And now with the word hospitality, that came from the Palestinians. They were the most hospitable people, and they still are.
Mm-hmm.
Just giving you anything. And you saw so many examples in the Bible of Jesus doing that same hospitality, and other people offering him hospitality. And it's a culture of care and a culture of love. And they see the commonality of our hearts. And that's what I think is so beautiful. And even on the worst days, their language is peppered with, God is so good. Thanks be to God. May God go with you. May God bless you. May God keep you. And they're as close to the ground of Bethlehem as they are to God, which is just amazing. Churches are full and overflowing. The rosaries are full and overflowing. And they have so many beautiful traditions. Like, they still do the presentation of the baby at 40 days.
Wow.
In the Catholic Church, which is so beautiful. And it brings you right back to Jesus's presentation with Anna and Simeon. And those are things that we could really lose if we have too much Christian migration.
Right. So how long will you stay on this trip? Because I know you said you're leaving this week.
Yeah, I'll be there for a couple weeks. And my schedule is chock full. And then I've got to come back to spend a little time with my mother. And then I've got some medical appointments. And then I'll go back. So I go back and forth pretty regularly. And always have my passports with me, just in case I need to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really looking forward to being back. The people really need us. And they don't just need our prayer and our money. They need us. They need
you there.
Accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
They need us to walk with them. They need the solidarity because it's scary. And when we're there, somehow it just makes them feel that they're not alone.
And they're not forgotten, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, lest we forget Bethlehem. You know, Bethlehem was forgotten forever. You know, you think about the times of King David and it was a backwater. And you think about it being the place where the sheep were grown for the temple. And, you know, nobody really thought too much about Bethlehem, but it was the, you know, the ancestral home of both the Blessed Mother and Saint Joseph. And what's really interesting is, do you know that on Christmas they conduct a census of the people every year?
I didn't know that, really. Wow.
Yes. Just like before, and I have a copy of last year's census. I haven't seen this one yet. And last year, there were 6,721 Roman Catholic people, babies, old people. And you get it, and it has the name of the family, the name of the tribe, the name of
the
clan.
How beautiful.
The age of each person. And it's no different from in the times of Jesus. And something about that is just so heartfelt, and it makes you feel like you belong. A friend of mine once said to me when I told her, well, in the United States, we don't have the presentation of babies. We only have the baptism. And she looked at me and she said, well, how do you feel welcome back at church after you have a baby?
Wow.
And I looked at her and I said, wow, how did I feel welcome? Like, what do we do to welcome young mothers back, families back?
Yeah.
Anyway,
Michelle, we're out of time. Let me give the website again, and please keep in touch with us. I'd love to have you back on when you're there. We're talking, of course, the last 45 minutes with Ambassador Michelle Bowe, the Holy Family Hospital Foundation, the Order of Malta, an amazing ministry, birthplaceofhope.org. We'll be right back. We're having a beautiful New Year's Eve so far. Now, I did promise you, going into the 2 cents segment, some New Year's quotes, which I didn't get to because I was so moved and emotional about the gospel for today, which I just loved. I love that gospel. Anyhow, there's some really nice ones that I found, and I just think it's kind of cool to get quotes from folks and just kind of reflect on them. So here's one from Brad Paisley. Tomorrow is the first blank page of a 365-page book. Write a good one. I love that. Learn from yesterday, live for today, hope for tomorrow. Albert Einstein. It's never too late to be what you might have been. George Eliot. Just a few words from some people who are, you know, at least contemporary in the sense of living over the past 100 years or so. I thought that was really cool. And of course, Brett Paisley, well-known country music artist, simple but very beautiful and true statement he made about giving ourselves new beginnings, which Christ provides for us every single day. Never forget that. Maybe 2025 didn't go so well for you. It's okay. God allows U-turn after U-turn after U-turn and fresh beginnings, new beginnings, beginning again, because he is Jesus, and he loves us, and he has only our best interests and our souls in mind. Happy New Year. We'll talk to you at the special edition on New Year's Day and back live with you, God willing, on Friday. Ciao, ciao.